Hey guys, and welcome to Hunting Land, presented by Great Days Outdoors Magazine. If you'd like to stay up to date on hunting tactics, land management, land values, and land market dynamics, this is the podcast for you. This week's show is brought to you by Great Days Outdoors Magazine. If you're frustrated with typical hunting and fishing magazines and tired of reading content, meant for guys that are up in the north or up in the Midwest, check out Great Days Outdoors Magazine. Don't get left behind following the guidance of guys who don't fish or hunt in your home state. You can pick up a Great Days Outdoors Magazine subscription, and it will help you become a better Southern outdoorsman. Great Days Outdoors Magazine can be found at your local Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, Tractor Supply Company, Rural King, Bass Pro Shops, or you can save online at greatdaysoutdoors.com. Air Medcare. Would your insurance cover an air ambulance in a medical emergency? The fact is, insurance often doesn't cover the full cost of medical flights, leaving you and your loved ones at financial risk. But with an Air Medcare Network membership, you can focus on recovery and not on finances should the unexpected happen. Air Medcare takes care of everything, with no costs for flights only when flown by one of our providers. Membership covers your full household and starts at $99 a year. Visit gdo.deals/airmedcare to enroll.
All right, guys, welcome to another episode of Hunting Land. I am your host, Butch Theory, and I'm joined today with Nick Williams, the host of the Alabama Freshwater Fishing Report over at Great Days Outdoors. How are we doing today, Nick?
Man, we're doing good. I'm excited to be here today, excited about the topic. In a past life, they called me Nutter Buster.
So
I'm excited
yeah?
to put that hat back on for an hour.
Yeah, man. Today we're going to be talking about saddle hunting safety and saddle hunting in general. I know this is something that you've kind of been in the weeds for nearly a decade. It has certainly been rising in popularity. Why saddle hunting, man? I know that you hunt a little different than me as far as, you know, more public land and, you know, having to trek back there at all, a long, long ways and think about what you're carrying, how heavy it is, and your setup and minimalizing everything in order to be mobile. Is that why you got into it? Kind of walk us through what was the draw for you to saddle hunting?
Yeah, for sure. So just the short history, and I don't know, I know me and Joe have talked about this. I've talked about this with a lot of other people, but I don't think you and I've had the conversation. So I got into public land hunting when I was in college. I didn't have time between working 3 part-time jobs, going to school full-time. Like, I just couldn't make it up to the lease on the weekends. You know, that wasn't a thing. I couldn't do like my dad and knock off early on a Friday and come back late Sunday. Like, I had to work, I had to study. So I missed a deer season and was a miserable person to be around. So I said, I can't do that anymore. I got to figure out how to hunt the public land here local. And I cut my teeth hunting public land at the Jacinto Port Track there in Saraland. And it's a big place, big walk-in place, walk-in only. And yeah, like, that stuff will wear you down. Back in the day, I had an old steel climber that I was trying to strap to my back and walk in with everything I needed. And
oh, yeah.
Even when I was in college in good shape, like, if you're doing that 2 or 3 days a week all through hunting season from October till January, dude, it ran me ragged. And I started looking for a better way and stumbled on saddle hunting, stumbled upon, I think, the first kit that I had back in the day was 4 Lone Wolf custom gear climbing sticks to big full length 32 inch ones, and an old trophy line that I'd found on a Craigslist ad. And I thought I was high speed, low drag, because instead of a 40 pound stand, I had about 20 pounds worth of stuff I was carrying in. And it makes a difference, man. It's lighter. It's not as bulky, you know, as a big Summit on your back, so you can carry it through the palmettos and the bushes. And then, you know, on public land, it's not, at least for me then, like, it's changed now because I've had, like you said, over a decade of experience hunting here. So you kind of start to know the area, but I was new, man. Like, there's 90,000 acres of upper and lower Delta WMA. I didn't know it. I didn't know what type of terrain I would be hunting in on a given day. You know, like, you're scouting deer in deer season, trying to make up for last time, and you may be in a tree that could barely hold your weight. You may be in some great big huge, you know, the one pine tree in a swamp that they didn't cut when they cut it in the 80s, you know.
Right,
like they,
right.
just couldn't, they just couldn't get to it. Now this thing's so big around, you can't, you're not putting cables around it. So I kind of got into it, and then it just kind of snowballed. And to be honest, it became, playing with the gear became just as much of a hobby as hunting out of it did. You know, it was like people who bow hunt, you know, you start bow hunting for that extra month of season in October, And then you get to where you just like to shoot your bow. You like to tinker with your bow. So I did that, got active on the forum, worked a little bit with Dan Osterhout at Eastern Woods Outdoors and learned a little bit about it. I'm not the biggest expert out there, but I knew more about it than the average bear back when I was doing it. And I'm excited today to just see where it's going. Like saddle hunting is exciting to me. It's like fly fishing. It's exciting because you're seeing it grow. And that's not always something you see in the hunting world. You know, it's not like you see something get bigger and bigger in the hunting world year after year. But the growth in saddle hunting has been really exciting for the past, I guess, 10 years now, like you said. So.
Yeah, man, before we dive into this thing with Van, I'd like to I'm a climber, lock-on guy. I'm hunting a lock-on. I pick my tree well in advance, put screws in tree or put the step screws in trees or do the sticks where I actually hook them to the tree, climb up it, or if I'm climbing, always have a lifeline on. So just kind of walk us through, quickly, concisely, just kind of walk us through your setup. Like you mentioned that you trimmed all the weight, had your saddle. Just like, what are the basics? How do you, whenever you get to the bottom of the tree, walk me through all your components and how you get up to the top of the tree.
So it can be a little more complicated if you're carrying all your gear in and out on public land. If you're going to a lease, you can prep a spot just like you would if you got a hang on. You can have climbing sticks going 20 foot up in the tree. You can have a little small platform at the top, and you literally just wake up in the morning, clip your saddle around your belt, just like you might put on your climbing harness back at camp. You put your saddle on, and it's got a bag on it with your lineman's belt and your tether, and you just climb up, tether in, pull your bow up, and you're hunting. Public land, it's a little bit more involved. So usually you're walking in and you're carrying climbing sticks are the most popular. So like me personally, I've got four climbing sticks and I've usually got a gun over my shoulder or a bow in one hand. I've got a set of four climbing sticks that weigh, I don't know, 7, 8 pounds in the other. And you got a little small platform on that top stick. And it's basically you just walk up, set your bow down, clip a tow rope to it. You just start putting sticks on a tree and you go up. And it's the climbing is very similar to what you would do if you, I know guys down here in the deep south like to use climbers, but if you're a hang on guy, it's the same type thing. You're walking in with a stand and sticks. And if you're saddle hunting, you're just walking in, you're wearing your saddle and you're carrying your sticks, and you may have a 1 or 2 pound platform instead of a big 20 pound hang on, So it's pretty straightforward. If you've ever climbed with a hang on, Butch, if you've ever climbed and put sticks up and hunted that evening, same thing, very similar.
Yeah, I could figure that out. Thank you for painting that picture, man. Today, we're going to be talking about saddle hunting safety with Hang Free. And to do that today, Van Wilkes, he's the co-owner of Hang Free. Welcome to Hunting Land, Van. Tell us a little bit about you and how you got started in Hang Free and a little bit about what you guys do over there and what you specialize in.
Of course. Well, thank you for having me. And yeah, virtually we are kind of a one-stop shop for everything you need saddle hunting wise. We manufacture saddle hunting equipment, mostly ropes. That varies from small little accessories to bring your sticks up the tree with you, all the way into the actual saddle itself. We started out, and I believe it was 2021. It was just my brother and I at the time, and slowly we've kind of grown into a small team, but a good working team, and we get a lot of products out. But mainly, we trying to save people on costs and still produce a really high quality product. That's our kind of like main goal when it comes to saddle hunting gear.
Yeah, I've been looking at your website, and man, it's totally different from when I first started saddle hunting. I started in 2015 or 2016. By 2017, I was pretty big into it, but you were just piecing stuff together back in the day, like the bad old days. You were trying to find old trophy line saddles, and you were trying to, making the trip to Birmingham here in Alabama to try to pick up some rappelling rope. Like you were just cobbling kits together. And to look at it now, y'all've got everything. Y'all've got the saddles, you've got gear hangers, you've got rappel rope, you've got the hardware, the ascenders, descenders, carabiners. I mean, it's just a dizzying selection of stuff. And it's all just right there. It's all priced right. Like it's a clean layout. I mean, the good old days are here as far as I'm concerned with saddle hunting stuff. Y'all've got a really nice site.
Yeah, and we've actually reduced it down to 230 products. I believe when we initially started, we were just at about 330. And then
Wow.
obviously everything is customizable for the most part. So I think we have just around 16,000 variations of products you can kind of choose from, I guess, or it's almost like a like Nike ID where you can design your own type of thing, not as high tech, but you can pick colors, links, different things like that. So what I learned early on is everyone's going to hunt differently. Everyone's going to have a very different method of actually saddle hunting, which is kind of like the great part about it is you can build it to how it works for you. And you know, obviously it's going to take one guy these pieces of gear to make his system work and another guy, you know, 10 completely different pieces. So we really wanted to try to offer at least something that, you know, even if we're only helping out with two or three pieces of your kit, then you can at least get something and make your life a little bit easier, as you know, we are located in Florida as well. So it gets real hot and the last thing I want to be doing is struggling up that tree early in the morning or late at night, sweating and just honestly not having as good of a time hunting.
Yep, no doubt about that, man. And I'm not too far from you over here on the Gulf Coast. As Nick kind of alluded to there, he's the professional here. I've actually never sat in a saddle, so I'm a beginner. So I'll be the beginner today, and I'll ask the stupid questions. I'm not scared to at all. Today we're going to be talking about, the safety hunting, or excuse me, saddle hunting safety mostly. Just tell us a little bit about, explain the basics of saddle hunting. I think the big draw to it is being mobile, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the main thing is being able to hang a set in basically any tree, hunt out of really, I mean, a tree from 5 inches around to as big as you can possibly reach. And also, obviously, being able to pack out, pack in without breaking your back. I mean, a climber might be marketed as 20 pounds, but you end up bringing your water, your food, your ropes. And by the end of it, you're in for like 40 or 50 pounds. And that's how I actually initially got into it. I was doing a lot of public land hunting right when COVID hit, as seemingly a lot of people were, and I just could not pack out that climber every time. I mean, and I ended up sitting in the same tree and realized I needed to find a different method and got into saddle hunting. And I mean, it just was a big spiral there. But yeah, I mean, virtually your basics for saddle hunting are going to be. You're gonna have your climbing sticks, your platform, and then you're gonna have your actual saddle, your lineman's tether, and that is like, I mean, as basic as you can get. Obviously, a lot of guys will then add in hip pouches for carrying your ropes, adding little like molly clips so you can carry your sticks up the tree. You can change out your attachment system for your platform and your sticks, and I mean, you can really, really cut your weight down to almost nothing. I think. A lot of guys will look at it and initially think that it's going to be a lot faster. I always tell people it doesn't speed you up a whole lot. It really just minimizes your weight and allows you to get places a lot of guys aren't willing to go when they're packing in 50 pounds or 60 pounds. And it allows you to really customize it to you to make it at least easier. Even though you might not be getting up the tree any faster, you're not putting in as much effort, one, getting to the tree or getting up the tree.
Van, talk to me a little bit. So I know, like you said, people think it's going to make them faster and you can get into any tree. And I know a big draw to saddle hunting is people get into it public land, but then there's also the guys who are getting into it from the safety point of view. And, I heard it thrown around, especially a lot in the early days, that a saddle was the safest way to hunt out of a tree, right? Because you're connected to the tree the whole time, which is true and awesome. And then kind of as I watch the sport grow, I know, like you said, there's so many different ways to customize the gear that you have. So what I started to see when you started seeing people play with these different climbing methods and you started seeing people play with different attachment methods, and there's not a lot of standards in the hunting world, And there wasn't a lot of crossover knowledge from the rock climbing and rappelling world early on that was coming over. So what I kind of started seeing was a lot of practices that made me raise my eyebrows. And that was in my 20s when I was pretty fast and loose myself. And now that I'm 30 and a dad, I'm definitely much more safety conscious than I used to be. Talk to me a little bit about that. Like I know, saddle hunting is in theory really safe because you're tethered to the tree, but I know a lot rides on that connection, right? Like if you don't have a good connection to the tree, then saddle hunting is not particularly safe because you don't really have a secondary safety system, right? It's not like you're sitting in a stand and then if that stand fails, you have a harness to back you up. What's kind of your thoughts on the safety aspect and why what you guys do. I know that was something that, and I think it's settled down a little bit more because there's more people like Hang Free that are offering good equipment. But you know, like y'all have good ropes, good carabiners and stuff like that. Talk to me a little bit about the importance of having good gear and a good tether connection when you're saddle hunting.
No, absolutely. I mean, in all honesty, the where you're going to see the most like kind of like dangerous side of things is going to be when guys start making their own gear. The amount of information, the amount of kind of knowledge you have to have to do what we do in terms of splicing, sewing rope, like sewing saddles, it's a lot more complex than a lot of people think it is. You can watch a YouTube video and see some guy do it and think, "Oh, I can do that for sure." And I mean, I can tell you from firsthand experience, that's how I started out. And I used, quite honestly, for my personal setup, it was a really unsafe stuff. I thought it was, oh, you know, AmSteel's working load is X amount. I'm going to be more than fine. But when you actually get into the actual techniques, what the like percentages of like strength lost on certain splices or certain like ways of, I guess, doing it, you know, it's hard to account for that when you haven't been doing it, I guess, professionally or with testing behind it. But I would say that's the most kind of like dangerous thing for saddle hunting is kind of making your own gear. But as long as you're going with like one of the larger companies, like one of the more reliable companies, you're going to be more than fine most of the time. The smaller companies, there are a few things out there that are not the kind of like safest thing. But I would definitely, one, make sure you do your homework, and two, make sure you're always tight to the tree. So like you did mention, you know, you don't have a secondary safety, so if your stand fails, you know, you're caught by your tether. It'd be virtually the same thing for saddle hunting. The reason a lot of people will say it's safer is because you're going to have a more redundant system where basically there's very little to no slack in your system at all times. So as you're actually climbing the tree, you should be connected in with your linemans, where as long as you keep it at waist level or above waist level, you're going to have very little to no slack. I mean, the number, like, a lot of companies will sell their saddles or sell their gear as fall the rest, when quite honestly, it's not. We're using really high strength, not like a static rope, so that it doesn't have much stretch to it. So you don't want to take a fall there. Not only static ropes don't take falls super well, but they also aren't going to feel great if you were to fall a further distance. So you should technically be at least testing all of your gear as a company that's manufacturing gear to OSHA's fall restraint standards. That's going to be a minimum brake strength for, this is for the saddle or any like life supporting equipment that is, but that'll have a minimum brake strength of 4,000 pounds. And it's basically saying that you keep 2 feet or less slack in your system. So as long as you're doing that, you're going to be just fine with any of the kind of like more commonly known companies. You can get into some more dangerous things when you start looking at the smaller companies or the guys that are on eBay or Etsy that are making stuff at home. While I'm not trying to bash those guys at all, that's where we started, and there's definitely guys out there that are making good gear. Just really do your homework, and you know, there's so many forums and so many Facebook groups that you can go on and ask the guys that have been in the industry for a long time, hey, have you heard about this piece of gear? What do you know about it? Is it safe? You know, have you heard of this company? And just really ask around and do your homework before jumping into it and just buying things that either look cool or sound good or whatnot. So, you know, just I guess do your homework, make sure you're doing getting good gear, go with a reliable company, read reviews and you know, listen to other guys. You know, for the most part, everyone is going to be very helpful in this industry, and yeah, it should make your at least safety and just overall buying experience a lot easier and better.
It definitely makes sense. So both of you guys mentioned knots, carabiners, and ropes there. As far as, you know, being safe and reliable with the carabiners and the ropes, is it as simple as, you know, looking at your weight limit for the carabiner and the rope, or what goes into selecting a rope and all your carabiners and knots and things like that? Is it just material and weight limit, or kind of walk us through that a little bit?
Yeah, so there's going to be certain ropes that are better for particular applications than others. You're not going to see us selling like a 40-foot AmSteel rappel line. AmSteel doesn't do well with heat, doesn't do well with stretch. We don't even want you to be able to fall, you know, 6 feet or 8 feet. So The longest like Amstel tether will sell will be 8 feet. But once that's around the actual tree, you're really playing more with 3 to 4 feet of slack at most. And then again, our instructions will be different versus something like our 10 millimeter Safety Pro, which is a more static, or I guess it would be, no, that'd be a dynamic fall, but it's basically, I can't remember the word at the current moment, but it's a lot more stretchy. It has a nylon core and a polyester sheath. So basically, if you were to take something like a 6 foot fall, that rope's going to do a whole lot better than something like a, I think like a W or UHWMPE, which is all the Dyneema fibers that you see, or like Amsteel Blue, things along those lines. So when it comes to rope, it's very, very complicated. Certain knots will be stronger than others. Kind of like to list out what will be the strongest, it'll be a splice. The second strongest will be a stitched eye, and then the third strongest will be a tied eye. So, you know, like there's so much confusion in this industry just from all the companies selling different things, and some do like a sewn eye, but with a tied prusik or a friction hitch. And then they'll base it off of that sewn eye for the main line, but it should always be based off of the weakest point of your system.
Sure.
Our main, like one of our more popular tethers right now is called a 8 millimeter Predator. The main line is rated, it's actually in reverse. So the friction hitch is stronger than the actual main line, but the main line ends up being like 4,400 pounds. And then you'll have a friction hitch that's, I think, at 4,500. Well, we're not going to base it off of that friction hitch. We're going to base it off of the main line. So not only do you have to go and do like a static pull or like a straight pull test, just breaking it, getting your numbers, but then you also have to go and get your drop test done by a third party, of course. They're going to do it a lot better than you will. You're always going to try to sway things to your side if you're doing it yourself because you like the product and you want to get it out to people. But having a third party that tests it, doing it the right way without any bias is definitely the way to go. And then obviously just paying attention to, you know, what you're actually making, especially when it comes to like sewing, stitching, or splicing an eye. You definitely, like, I'm not gonna make an eye-to-eye connector, form it into a swabish hitch, for example, and then go and test that. And then it tests like X amount of break strength and then turn around and make it with a completely different hitch and sell that to the public. It's just not, it's not what we tested. It's not what you know, we know is safe, and it's trying to stick to your standards, and we turn people down every day looking for something custom, and we're like, I'm sorry, like we know it's strong enough, but we can't sell it. It hasn't been tested. So, you know, some things, if you want a custom mater, I know the working loads and all the different like basically kind of splice techniques in my head that I'm able to go, okay, well, that's going to be more than strong enough. And then lastly, you always want to apply your factor of safety. So if, for example, that Predator, which is I think rated minimum break strength at 4,420 pounds, I'm then going to apply a 10 to 1 at the least. That will depend on the rope you're using. 10 to 1 factor of safety, which will bring your working load to about 440 pounds. So that means if a guy that's 440 pounds takes a certain distance fall, it'll still catch him.
That's man, it is super refreshing to hear that y'all are getting that stuff tested by third parties and that you're running the math. And I know there's guys out there who are listening thinking, man, like 4,500 pound brake strength, that's overkill. I know there was lots of questionable stuff getting done back in the day with Amsteel. I saw a few paracord bridges and people were saying, ah, it's fine, it's 550 cord and I don't weigh but 180 pounds. And it's like, man, I really that doesn't work that way. That's not how that works at all. You know,
How
it
much do
can,
you weigh when you're going 20 miles an hour?
it's
Right.
yeah. So it, and if you've never done it, I would encourage people get on some of the rock climbing sites and look at some of the fall calculators and do the math on the forces that you can generate just with a 2 foot fall. I mean, you quickly start generating large amounts of force and, you know, include a factor of safety in there for if your gear is a little dirty, you know, if it's been out there for a few years in the tree, you know, if it's wet, like all kinds of things can influence it. So yeah, that may sound crazy at first to most guys having a 4,500 pound rope, but that all those pounds dwindle quickly. They get eaten up once you start doing fall calculations for sure.
Well, if I'm going to be hanging from a tree, I want overkill.
Yeah,
If I'm going
for
to be
sure.
dangling above the ground, I want the overkill. Give me the 5,000 pound one. I want it all.
But it's like I said, it is very, very confusing. You're gonna have a 4,400 pound predator line that is again a polyester sheath and a nylon core, and it's gonna absorb a lot of shock a lot better than something like a I don't want to call any companies out, but like a Dyneema core based tether that they're rating for maybe 8,000 pounds, but in all reality, when you shock load a Dyneema core tethered or a like HMPE core tether with a polyester sheath, the sheath isn't doing anything there. It's mainly the core, and it's going to break at a significantly lower strength than 8,000 pounds. So you might, depending on the rope, again, just do your research, and you might end up actually wanting the, in quotes, weaker rope. It's very dependent. That's why, again, I mean, going with a company that's well known, that's been out for a while, and that has good reviews and guys that are pushing their products, I would try to stick with them and then maybe experiment and try stuff at ground level. If there's a product you see on eBay or Etsy or you want to make yourself, try it at ground level, beat the heck out of it. If it works, make a new one and go up in the tree. It's just taking it slow, like learning. Reading was, it just, I mean, I spent countless hours, probably thousands of hours. I mean, just simply reading about rope, reading like, I know I always like a kind of a little bit of an inside joke with the guys here and some customers we have, but I know more about rope than dentists know about teeth. That's what I always say.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, I'm an absolute rope nerd. That's probably the only time you'll ever hear that, but yeah, it's my job, so take it seriously.
Yeah, somebody needs to. And I like you've mentioned several times at this point that, if you're buying from a big manufacturer, and not to name names, but like if you're buying from say the big T's in the industry, like they're most of those bigger companies, they have guys at the helm who understand the risk. And you're gonna have good gear in it, but it may be basic. Like I know I've got some of those package deals where you pull that tether and you pull that lineman's belt out, and I mean this big thick 11 12 millimeter stuff, big huge Prusiks on it, big huge steel carabiners, and it's safe. But you get this little monkey in the back of your brain that's like, man, like I got into saddle hunting to be high speed, low drag. I don't want to carry all that. Like my rope pouch is big as a basketball, so. And what I used to see is that's where people would get in trouble. They'd say, well, maybe I want to try some of these 9 millimeter ropes I've heard about, or these 8 millimeter ropes. And then they start building stuff, and you start making those hitches, and you can't really put not like you can put an 8 millimeter hitch on an 8 millimeter rope. So you got to go down to some smaller accessory cord, and you got to worry about the brake strength of your accessory cord that you're tying your friction hitches with. And then you start into kind of doing your home brews, and now you've got somebody who's not necessarily a rope nerd, and it's not just a matter of the equipment, but it's also, back in the day, I used to see some pictures of some hitches that were very suspect, didn't have enough tag end or didn't have a stop or not, just little stuff like that that seems harmless but throws up a big red flag if you've done enough stuff like that. And I see that y'all sell, y'all sell pre-made stuff, which is awesome. That didn't used to really be something that was big out there in the market, but I see y'all also sell rope by the foot. I know there's always every year there's going to be people who build their own tethers, linemen's belts, aiders. I used to do all of that stuff myself, and there's a right way and there's a wrong way to do it. What's your advice when it comes to the knots? Like I think you've given us a really good argument on why you should have a good rope, but if the knot's not tied right, that's not going to do you any good, no matter what super rope you're hanging off of.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say my number one piece of advice is stay off of YouTube when it comes to rope. For the most part, what you're going to learn on YouTube is going to be guys that are doing it for the maybe fourth or fifth time themselves, and that quite honestly don't know a ton. What I did learn how to splice ham steel off of YouTube, or at least got the basics. And then as I really, really got into it, I quickly realized that the videos out there are not right, like at all. If it's the taper length or the how to Brummel splice, they skip a lot of the small details that you think, if oh, who you know, if I don't have a perfect Brummel, it doesn't matter that much. Well, it matters significantly. But in terms of ropes and knots, I would really try to stick to the manufacturer's like recommendations. So a lot of what we're going to sell is either Samson or Samson Rope Technologies or Sterling Rope. A lot of them will like show you how to tie certain knots, show you what knots should be used for what. Stick to like, I guess, the catalogs or the direct instructions versus going and watching some guy on YouTube who may have just heard it from a friend or it might work for him. Like a great, I guess, knot you can tie would be a distal hitch. That's or a friction hitch. The problem is when you get a guy that's 300 to 350 pounds and he goes from a leaning position into a sitting position, the distal hitch typically will start slipping a little bit. So it's not like a quick, you're never going to fall straight to your stop or not, but you're slowly just going to keep on lowering and lowering. But again, that is also might be due to the rope compared to the like I guess it would be called like the ratio of your friction hitch to your actual main line. So you never want to exceed 3/4. Okay, I guess a better, easier way to explain it would be if you have an 8 millimeter tether, you never want to go over 6 millimeter, a 6 millimeter prusik. Preferably a 5 millimeter would be the way to go. There's just that I know of no 5 millimeters that are out there that are also going to meet that OSHA fall restraint standard. But it's a couple of quick knots that are good to use are going to be a figure eight, like for your actual eye, like a big eye for like a tether. You can tie a figure eight knot. And you have a double fisherman's that'll be for like your prusik or like your friction hitch of your choice. And those would be like the two main ones you probably want to go with. You can use like a, even like a slip knot, like a basically a fisherman's, a double fisherman's, but as an eye-to-eye connector that connects into your carabiner. But it also it just depends on the rope. So that's why I'm saying you really want to pay attention to what the manufacturers recommend. We'll get bashed a lot of the time over what like tying an overhand knot into ropes. And I mean, hey, to be completely honest, is it as strong? Probably not. Is it still more than strong enough to hold you up? Absolutely. It uses less material. We can do it a little bit faster and we can get it to you for a little bit better of a price while still keeping you more than safe. You know, that we'll sometimes just throw an overhand knot in there. But again, that's only going to be on certain ropes, typically the ones that are exceeding 5,000 or 6,000 plus pounds. On like the Predator tie-dye tether alignments that we sell, it's a double fisherman's and a figure eight, which the figure eight does a very good job of retaining strength. So that's why we'll have it on those little bit weaker ropes. And then obviously for the super high strength ones, it honestly doesn't really matter. Whatever knot is going to hold, that's going to be more than fine on those ropes.
And just to clarify, when you say an overhand, are you talking about like for your tether loop, like an overhand on a bike, or just like
Exactly.
a, okay. I didn't know if you were talking about an overhand as like a stopper knot on the end or okay. I got you. Yeah. Well, speaking of stopper knots too, what are y'all usually tying your tethers for stopper knots and for your ends of your prusik loops and stuff like that? What do y'all recommend?
So everything will be a double stopper knot for us. So when I said like a double fisherman's, that's basically what it is. A lot of people call it different things, a slip knot or the other names that people refer to them as a slip in my mind, but we all refer to them as double fisherman, which is basically a double stopper knot on like a prusik cord that when you pull the sides of it cinches itself together. And then obviously for tethers for the actual like thing that prevents you from slipping off would be just a standard double stopper. I believe we might even have a YouTube video on it. If not, there's, I mean, that's one that you could trust YouTube on, and it's a pretty simple knot to tie. But also that same knot will also be found all over the PDFs or the written out instructions that Sterling, Samson, Yale. I mean, I could name 10 different companies that will give you virtually the same instructions on how to tie knots.
Talk to me a little bit about carabiners. I know I got into many heated discussions on the forum back in the day about the various types of locking carabiners, and I always felt like it was pretty unanimous that people wanted some sort of locking carabiner. But then I heard all kind of arguments about which type of locking carabiners were the most secure. I know you've got open gate strength, closed gate strength, Y-axis strength, stuff like that. What's the current wisdom on good carabiners that won't kill you?
Yeah, currently you're going to see most companies selling theirs with some sort of locking carabiner. Most typically it'll have a black diamond like Hot Forge. That's going to be a pretty affordable one. That's also going to be, I think, at 22 kilonewtons strength, which is somewhere around like maybe 6,000 pounds. I'm not sure the exact difference there, but the main reason you're going to want a locking carabiner is just basically if you were to take fall and you would have slack in your system, there's a much higher chance. Now that chance is still very slim, but there's a significantly higher chance of you being able to basically become unclipped from that rope. There's certain ways you can fall that the rope itself will actually unlock the carabiner. And there's, again, a bunch of videos on how that can happen on YouTube. Like how not to is a YouTube channel that I watch like a lot of, and they'll kind of give you like a more in-depth, they're big into like rock climbing, but give you a more in-depth like look at how certain knots are tied and what those are going to break at. And they do a ton of break strength testing, but they'll tell you how you can fall out of a, carabiner that even if it's just a wire gate carabiner. Basically, though, you're gonna have a higher chance of becoming unclipped from your tether or rappel line or whatever it is that you're using a wire gate carabiner versus a locking carabiner, which you can obviously screw tight. Virtually also, the screw gate carabiners will also typically test at a higher strength, as you can kind of lock that up and it helps hold it together as it's getting basically pulled apart. And then obviously you're gonna have your, like you mentioned, your open gate, your shut gate, your lock it, like locked gate testing, your minor access, your major access. A lot of that, the testing is very confusing when it comes to carabiners. Mainly you're looking for, I believe it is your major access, which is basically kind of how you have to orientate a carabiner in a saddle hunting like situation, where it's pulling on, if you have like an oval carabiner, for example, it's pulling on the two skinny ends or the two tight bends in that carabiner. That's going to be, I believe it, that's your major axis. So almost always that's how your carabiner has to be orientated when you're saddle hunting. So that's kind of what you want to pay attention to. Most wire gates, even though, will be technically strong enough. They just are, again, going to have a higher chance of you coming out of that carabiner, which obviously is not good when you're 20 plus feet up in the tree.
It's if you've never seen it before, that's another thing. I know on a podcast you're limited in what you can show, but I would encourage people pause right now and just Google carabiner gate mishaps and see how quick it is. The first time somebody showed me a wire gate, like demonstrated how easy it was to slip a wire gate free. And then I had one guy who was a rock climbing instructor who showed it happening with auto lockers and screw gates and stuff like that. And you can really get into the weeds of, double locking carabiners and stuff like that. Like for the rock climbing guys, they're super serious about those carabiners staying shut no matter what happens. But I kind of went full circle. I tried when I first started saddle hunting, I had a big screw gate, and then I tried some various auto lockers and stuff like that. And then the more I learned about carabiners, the more I just went with a good old fashioned screw lock. Because it's and screw them. Take the 5 seconds when you use them. I know when I was bad about that when I first started. It's like, well, it'll be fine. I'm just hopping up a tree real quick while my line's belt. Like I don't want to. It's I didn't oil it and it's got a little squeak. I don't feel like a squeaky carabiner today. But don't do that. When you see the videos, it'll scare you straight.
And then that, especially a lot of rock climbing, you're not messing with your gear too much, but as you're climbing up the tree saddle hunting, you might be reaching down trying to fix a stick that's beneath you or get something off your saddle and you're turned in a kind of a weird way. And that's where a lot of the time your non-locking carabiners can really be dangerous when you're kind of turning or reaching in a weird way and your rope might end up laying across it, like the non-locking carabiner, at a certain angle or hits it and you're not paying attention to that because you're trying to grab something.
All right, guys, let's take a quick break. Check out a few of this week's great sponsors.
First South Farm Credit. What does a farm mean to you? Maybe it's just a piece of land where you can go relax or enjoy the outdoors. Whatever the farm means to you, First South Farm Credit can help you finance or refinance that perfect piece of land. As a successful financial cooperative, First South shares its profits with its borrowers in the form of a patronage refund, which lowers your cost of borrowing. To find out how First South can help you, visit their website at firstsouthland.com or call them at 800-955-1722. They are an equal housing lender. Texas Hunter. Since 1954, Texas Hunter Products has produced the best engineered and finest quality feeders and hunting blinds in the industry. The Texas Hunter brand has become synonymous with quality and durability. By sticking to premium standards, the company delivers tough, long-lasting products that meet the real-life needs of anglers and hunters across America. Their fish feeders, deer feeders, hunting blinds, and outdoor accessories are among the highest rated in the industry. You can trust that your purchase from Texas Hunter Products will meet your needs for generations to come. To learn more, visit texashunter.com. If you're looking for a beautiful state that's packed with outdoor attractions, check out Mississippi. Of course, you know about the Mississippi River, but there are a lot of great rivers for paddling throughout the state. Coastal Mississippi's waters are perfect for deep sea fishing or exploring the state's five uninhabited barrier islands. You'll find national forests with campgrounds, trails, and recreational sites, 25 state parks, and wildlife management areas too. Whatever you like to do in the great outdoors, you can do in Mississippi, where wanderers are welcome. Plan your adventure at visitmississippi.org/outdoors.
Van, I know we've talked a little bit about different friction hitches, and I know for most guys, get that first saddle set up, that's probably going to be what they got, right? Like the big box guys, I think they include them in there just to keep at a certain price point. It was what I first started out with, just a good old prussic hitch on my linemans and my tether, and I know I quickly found out that there were some mechanical devices that could make your life a lot easier. That was probably the biggest quality of life upgrades I made with my saddle hunting gear was when I started playing with Ascenders. But then I'll be honest, like beyond the Ropeman 1, the Ropeman 2, the Kong Duck and everything, I know everything just kind of ballooned, and there's a lot of hardware now that's getting used. I log on to the Saddle Hunter forum and I'm out of the loop on what's being used. I see that y'all sell, looks like I'm seeing Kong Ducks, I'm seeing the good old Ropeman, I'm seeing some devices that I recognize, but what are people commonly using now? And then what are the best practices? I know that those devices are convenient for sure, but they come with their own caveats and risks when you're using them. How do you mitigate those?
Yeah. So the most common ones you'll find, and I won't get too deep into like, you know, which ones fit what size rope and what we have a whole YouTube video. You can go watch that and figure out what exactly each one does. But your most popular are going to be a Kong Duck will probably be the most popular across the board in terms of all the companies and just the industry as a whole, quickly followed by the Ropeman 1, then the Ropeman 2, and then it's kind of an Ascender. It's more of a rappel device. That'll be the Mad Rock Safeguard, the springless version. Those are the one, those four, the Ascenders, and I guess technically a Descender that really have had no real like big problems. A Beal Birdie, which is another rappelling device that used to be pretty popular. They had, I believe it was a big old recall and some kind of major issues with them. And because of that, I can't remember the last time I've seen a company selling those. There's just a handful of other kind of like off-brand Ascenders that are either way too expensive for our applications, or they just don't fit the right size rope, where you'll see companies just not really selling them. To mitigate any, I guess, your main issues that you'll find with Ascenders are going to be slipping. So if you either don't put it on properly, I mean, we've sold well over 2,500, 3,000 Kong Ducks, had one issue with it, and that wasn't even the device's fault. The guy emailed in, was like, hey, can you take a look at this picture? Of this, like I basically slowly slipped down to the ground. He was on a rappel rope and sent the photo. And I was looking, I was like, well, if you look real close, your duck was never even shut all the way. So it was that he just didn't add it on right. Aside from that, which he even was like, look, I'm not even trying to give you guys a problem. I know this isn't your guys' fault, but I just want to make sure it wasn't a problem with the actual Kong duck itself, which it wasn't. It was just how he actually added it to the rope. So there's your first problem. Read the instructions. Make sure you actually know how to attach the Ascender, or watch a video and, you know, very closely follow that. But aside from that, it'll be just the Ascender slipping. We've never had one of ours or a customer of ours like come back and say that theirs have slipped. But I have heard of a couple on like Facebook groups and such like of them slipping. Basically, what we recommend is backing them up by adding a simple Prusik above them. So that still allows you to like use them like normal. Like if you tend them up with one hand, if your Prusik isn't long enough and that mechanical device hits the bottom of the Prusik, it'll tend that Prusik up. And then obviously coming down, you would have to actually move it with your hand. But in terms of like the inconvenience, adding a backup Prusik is to the benefits you have. It's well worth it. I think you could even do a tied one for a couple of dollars, or I think we sell sewn eye to eyes or sewn Prusa Gloops for right around $15. And, in the grand scheme of things, adding one of those on, $15 or, potentially having a real big issue with a fall, definitely well worth it. Even if it's, hopefully, and if you were to fall, you end up in the hospital. And obviously, there's a worse outcome when it comes to hunting gear, but $15 is a whole lot less expensive than a hospital bill. So definitely, back yours up. We have a video showing how to back your sender up. Even though, pay attention to the what you're actually, so for example, the Kong Duck is rated for 8 millimeters through 13 millimeters. Use it. Don't go and put your Kong Duck on a 7 millimeter line and hope that it's going to function right. Especially when it comes to the mechanical devices. The companies that I know of that sell them are giant companies. Oftentimes, they're like the Vertical Supply Group, for example. It's multiple companies all working together and they have to meet certain standards. So they're rigorously testing these devices and meeting standards, not only for the United States, but overseas as well. Overseas has a much more strenuous like testing standard that you have to meet. So they're going to be safe as long as you're using them properly. You don't want to go and put a Madrox safeguard on an 8 millimeter rope. That's not rated for that. You shouldn't do it. You're gonna have it. It's gonna slip. There is not a. It's not a. Oh well, I've seen a guy on YouTube do it, or I've seen a guy on Facebook do it. It's that the manufacturer who are selling these in mass, that have tested them and spent tens of thousands of dollars on testing, is telling you not to do it. So, back them up. Make sure you're following the instructions that the manufacturers give, and make sure you're obviously, buying one from a reliable source and not like a used one off of eBay or Etsy that who knows what could have happened to it.
Yeah, seems like a very important thing to have all your, like you say, I mean, the manufacturers know what they're doing. They're not going to give you the wrong advice, and be open up to liability. So don't use it for something that's not supposed to be used for.
Exactly.
I mean, that brings up another great point. Kind of talk about some of the common safety mistakes that new saddle hunters make and how can they avoid them? What do you see typically, like, people doing that are just starting out? What are some of the most unsafe things and how can they be avoided?
Yeah, absolutely. Number one, I would say, is attaching your linemans once you're at the top of your stick, like your first stick. A lot of guys will use aiders in this industry where that aider and your stick are going to get you about 6 feet off the ground. You kind of got a lot of weight on you, and you think when you're practicing in your yard, hey, I don't need alignments. I'll attach it when I'm at, I'm only 6 feet up. When you're 6 feet up and you got a platform or a whole bag on your back and your platform's there and you got a bunch of pointy things like sticks hanging off of you, that 6 feet fall becomes a lot bigger of an issue when a stick goes into your side or that platform hits the back of your head. So always make sure you're connected to the tree, even from the ground. I know it's something I definitely overlooked in the past. Almost took a little fall from, I think it was like 4 or 5 feet, and I knew that wouldn't have went well. And since then, I've been connected from the ground up. And then obviously keeping slack out of your system. Those are going to be the two most common things. So, a lot of people get into one sticking, which is climbing the tree with a rappel rope and a single stick. That's going to be the type of climbing that you're going to see the most slack in the system, as you have to kind of almost bypass your tether to be able to move it up the tree. So try to mitigate that. Try to practice at, a lower height with a lineman's belt also attached, where you're getting better at moving the linemans up and mitigating the amount of slack you're going to have in your system. Not only will that be safer for your, if you were to take a fall, you're taking a smaller fall, but then also, you don't want to, like I mentioned earlier, when you get into all these different ropes and such, you don't, some ropes, you're not wanting to take a large fall. So keeping a slack out of your system is going to basically prevent that. And then obviously staying connected to the tree, potentially even in two ways, maybe using a tether and alignments, depending on, again, what you're using, is also, also a very good way to mitigate slack, or to mitigate a fall, or basically a risk of injury.
That's a good tip, and I definitely agree with you that you should wear your lineman's belt even on that first second stick because go do a trust fall, go stand up on top of a 5 gallon bucket or a step stool or something and trust fall backwards with somebody and have them not catch you and get back with me about how that little shortfall ain't no big deal. It's
Yeah, it's also, just it's so many things. You like you said, like the weather, even if it's okay, hey, your rope caught you and you took a 6 foot fall, but can you get back up to your stand now, or can you reach back to your stick and then be able to climb, or are you going to be stuck there where you end up running into a lot of other issues where your circulation in your legs or something like wherever you're connected to is starting to become cut off and you start freaking out and getting frantic, and that's where you make even a larger mistake. Like you're uncomfortable, your circulation in your legs are going, you want to get out of that tree, and you take out your pocket knife and say, you know what, I'm cutting this rope, but it might not cut all the way through, turn you at a weird angle, and now you're falling face forward. Or, it's just by keeping slack out of your system is going to prevent 99% of the problems you're going to end up having. It kind of like regardless of the gear you're using. Sit down, like when you get your gear, what everyone wants to do is run out of the tree, climb up 20 feet, take some practice shots, rappel down, or whatever it is. And I always say slower is better. Like, I mean, kind of circles back to the beginning where I was saying, a lot of people think that saddle hunting is a speed thing where it speeds you up. In all reality, if you take your time, you make sure you're doing it right, you'll end up getting up that tree faster than you would if your intention was to race up the tree as fast as you can. And if you're taking your time, thinking about each move you're making, you're also going to be safer on the other end. So really, like, sit down when you get your gear, figure out what everything is, practice at ground level. And then as you're actually going to make your first real climb, just really focus on each thing that you're doing. Make sure that your toes point in the tree if you're using aiders. Make sure your alignment's belt is tight. Make sure that you're not tangled on a stick with a piece of rope that's hanging off of you, or whatever it is. You're just taking it really slow, really learning your setup, and that also will prevent a lot of mistakes you can make.
Yeah, slow and steady. I like it.
It's definitely true that slow is smooth and smooth is fast when it comes to climbing. I know one of my personal sins when I was climbing was not having that re redundancy, that second lineman's belt, or having a tether as an attachment point when you go up and around limbs. And I've watched a lot of guys do that, and it's like Joe By will tell you, it's all fine until it ain't, and then it goes downhill real quick, real
Till the
fast.
limb breaks, yeah.
That's it.
And you go weigh your pros and cons. A lot of guys will tell you to keep your hands outside. Like if you are one sticking, which is kind of similar to like a climber where you move that tree tether up with you to keep your hands outside of the tether. I would rather have my that they say that to prevent your hands from getting pinched. Personally, I would rather move it up with my hands inside and have my hands pinched by that tether than to have slack in it where I'm having to then reach back down and try to pick it up, which, that's put you at risk to a, 4+ foot fall, which you really just don't want to do.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, with one sticking or some of the different climbing platforms that are out there too, something that I used to be guilty of. You see it with people who are doing aiders and stuff like that, and I've gotten to the point where, man, carry the extra stick, use a 5-step instead of a 4-step aider, and just make one more move. Instead of trying to stretch and operate at the limits of what you can do, just make small movements. And especially practicing in the yard, you'll get there faster, you'll get there safer. And then if you're just practicing in the summertime and you've got in your head, I'm going to stretch and make these big moves and take these big steps on my sticks and my aiders, like you get bundled up and it's 20 degrees outside and
Not so mobile.
you don't have that range of movement. And then when you're climbing down, if you've been sitting there all day on a rut sit, like you don't have the dexterity that you think you're going to have coming back down in the dark.
Yeah,
So
absolutely. And that definitely, like, I think that kind of comes in like that weight area of the saddle hunting, which is like everyone's trying to cut their weight. So let me throw a stick away and then get 2 3-step hitters. Well, what I've seen a lot and what I personally do, I mean, is I kind of have a general weight that I want my pack to be. If I throw away a stick and cut it with some aiders, well, I'm just going to put more snacks in the bag, or I'm going to bring an extra water. I'm going to end up with roughly the same weighted pack. So it's like, hey, is that extra snacks you want to put in there? Just carry that too. You know what I mean? Don't worry about having to ditch something and have a little bit more of a risky like setup than. And then to then make up for that weight you lost in other areas. Just, I always say comfortability over, well, like lightweight, or how like cutting weight basically. So I'd rather be comfortable not only in my climb, but also in my sit, than to have a 14-pound pack that I can brag about on Facebook. Hey, look at my pack. I got, it's down to 14 pounds, and I'm like, yep, but you're also uncomfortable, and I know you are, because you don't have a back band, you don't have a knee pad, you don't have any of the actual things that make you comfortable. So, just don't always try to get the least or the lowest weight or lowest amount of gear. Just get what works for you, what you're comfortable with, not only in the actual climbing aspect, but also when you're actually sitting in the tree as well.
Yeah, some good tips there for sure. I think we've all covered it pretty well, and we can all agree how important these each component to this system is. What about maintenance and kind of inspecting our gear? Nick mentioned it in the opener. These things can sit out there sometimes. Sometimes they'll sit in the garage. I'm sure these things dry rot. Things sit out in the elements. We got water, we got mud, we got rain, we have all kind of things. So just kind of walk us through kind of the maintenance of your system, and how can you know that it's going to remain safe next time you get up the tree.
Yeah, number one, obviously, is going to be paying attention to the actual gear itself, whether it's rope, your carabiner, whatever it is. I would like all instructions that you're going to see, not only from us, but all other companies as well. Check your gear before climbing every time, whether that's making sure your carabiner's gate shuts and locks, or if you just quickly slide the rope kind of through your hands right in front of your face, making sure there's no frays, or you can actually sometimes you'll feel the core of the rope, depending on the rope. You can feel the core almost like break apart or basically not feel smooth, where it looks like it appears to be fine, but in all reality, if you've thrown in your bag and then something happened to your bag, or if you accidentally, I mean, I'm making up a situation here, but accidentally ran it over, well, you could have injured the core of your rope, but not the sheath. A lot of the time, the sheaths are going to be much more resilient, I guess, than the core itself. Just because you're running some type of friction hitch or a rappel device or something on the actual sheath, they need to be very strong. But the core is where you're going to have all of your actual strength come from. So, make sure you run your hand over it, make sure it feels the same as when you bought it, make sure the sheath itself also isn't, fraying real bad. And then again, it's going to come back to reading those instructions, not only from the actual saddle manufacturers, but the manufacturers of the raw rope. Because obviously we'll buy something from Sterling, then we turn it into what we sell. But not only do you we should read our instructions, but also theirs, making sure that you retire the rope when they recommend or when we do. Like most companies and most gear are going to be rated for about 2 years. Now, obviously, that will be dependent on one, how you take care of it, and two, how much you use it. If you get a real wet rope, don't go throw it in a bin and leave it in a dark garage. That's cool. That's going to get moldy. It's going to like things are going to end up happening to it that you might not even notice, but it's significantly going to like weaken it or hurt the integrity of it. Make sure it dries out first, but don't go throwing it in a drying machine either, because depending on the rope, too much heat can cause some issues there as well. So there's so many ropes I could sit here all day and try to cover them all, but just again, read those instructions, read what the manufacturer recommends, and try to at least as best as possible execute those instructions. We all love saddle hunting, we all love climbing, but you can't do that if you're not being safe and something were to happen. So obviously just pay attention to that, and the extra couple minutes it takes to read those things is insignificant compared to what the results could be of you not reading them.
You talk about doing the old squeeze test on your rope course. So I can give a really good example of what not to do with your rope. I was up at Joe's place and he shot a hog and we had a hard time blood trailing him. And by the time we found him and got the ATV to him, we were in a hurry to get out of the woods. And between the two of us, we were having a hard time loading it on the ATV. So he said, "Well, I'll go back to camp and we'll get a strap and we'll drag him." And I'm like, "Well, I'm sitting here with a 4,000 pound capacity rope on my saddle." I'm like, "Let's just hook him up. Let's just drag him up. Let's just get this over with, get back to camp." And I had, I think, an 8 millimeter Oplux rope with a Kong duck and a locking carabiner. And we sat there and we threw one end of that tether over the hitch on that UTV and we made a noose and slipped it around that big pig's neck. And we drug him probably 3/4 of a mile back to camp and cleaned him, had dinner and everything. And then after that, I sat there and I was inspecting that rope in the firelight. And I'm like, "Looks pretty good. It's a little bloody, but I got to doing the squeeze test up and down and dragging that big 300 and something pound pig right there where that Kong duck was. You could tell it was just flat and it was like, yep, nope,
Compromised.
Thanks.
There goes a $60 piece of rope. We'll have to replace.
Like kind of similar to what you mentioned, it also is always recommended that if you were to take some for sort of fall or like if their rope were to catch you or be shock loaded, I mean, it is technically recommended to just throw that away and go buy a new one. If you're not wanting to throw that away and buy a new one, because again, ropes are expensive for sure, but take that friction hitch off, check the friction hitch, check the rope, especially after a fall. That's where a lot of that, like you said, that Kong duck basically was biting in too hard and kind of flattened that section out. You really probably wouldn't notice it unless you did what you did, which is inspect it. So.
It looked pristine on the outside. It looked good. So, but yeah, that core was compromised. I did not feel good about hanging on it.
Yeah, that's smart, but it sucks when it happens to something like Oplux, which is like $2.20 a foot, and that's if you
It
buy
was
just that rope. So
Oh, it was nice. It was back in the day. There was only one manufacturer in the saddle hunt world that you could get a spliced Oplux tether from. And I've sprung for the spliced version. So,
I've only seen
or
splice.
no, sorry, sewn. It
Okay,
was a sewn
you
eye.
can splice it. I wouldn't. I have never even tried it. I feel that rope. And I'm like, nope. And I mean, I can splice just about anything you can think of. And I've only seen it splice one time. And I'll credit to that guy. But yeah, sewn is extremely popular. That's going to be a really. I think sewn. Don't quote me on it, but I think that's going to retain on average about 80 to 90%. No, splice is 90. It's going to retain about 70 to 80% of that rope strength. So it really is dependent. You might even see some on our website, like I think Predator's rated for 4,000 pounds just as the rope itself. To tell you the truth, Samson, who is a, I mean, they're massive. They're a huge company. They're the longest standing trademark in America. They are the second biggest rope supplier on the planet, and they basically just do calculations. So they never technically tested Predator for us. They just know for a fact it can meet these standards based off of, like, they have rope engineers. When we started working with them, I thought I knew a lot about rope. I quickly realized I had very little knowledge compared to these guys and ended up having to circle back and do a whole lot more reading. But so when we actually sew the rope and took it to a testing center, it tests higher, and we got the same test numerous times on the same type of stitch. And that's why you might see a little bit slightly higher break strength than the actual rope itself. They're just saying they know for a fact it can break it that, or it will not break until it gets that strength, whether you're tying it, sewing it, splicing it, anything like that. So, testing gets very, very complicated, but as long as it's by the third party and that you're testing it also in the way that it's going to be used, not just simply straight pull testing, then you should be good to go.
Well, Van, I know you've been helping us through what can get to be a kind of down in the weeds, dry technical conversation talking about safety. I feel like it's important. I personally know a guy down here in South Mississippi who had a fall out of the saddle, and talking with him, I think it comes down to just a bad friction hitch that he tied. So these accidents happen. I think it's important that people be educated and aware. So I appreciate you helping us with this. Before we wrap up, let's turn to some lighter subjects. I know fall is in the air, deer season's coming upon us. I see y'all got an awesome website, lots of great products. You said that y'all expanded y'all's lineup since y'all first started. Is there anything new that y'all have coming out for the 2024 season that y'all are particularly excited about?
No, absolutely. We just released actually this past Saturday. It's currently Tuesday, I think. I think it's Tuesday. It might be Monday. I don't know what day it is, but 3 days ago we released a Challenger saddle and Strata camo, along with kind of another line of gear, a back band, some bags. We've been working with True Timber now for a little over a year. They got delayed last year, and then we kind of revised the sizing and the actual design of the saddle, and we just released those this past Saturday. Already selling a pretty good amount of them, so I'm not sure how long we are out on this podcast, but they might be gone by the time this airs. But we released those along with some other ropes, like 9mm blackout, which is we're selling basically as a rappel rope only. So there's no like rappel device with it. You can always add that stuff, you know, in the hardware collection we have, but really some more rope options, just sonais, different lengths, things along those lines. And then one thing we haven't mentioned a ton of, but we've been working on for a real long time, is climbing sticks. So we're hoping those will at least start to be shown sometime in January, maybe at the ATA of, I guess, technically 2025. You know, we've been selling accessories basically for the past 3 years. We know what guys want, what guys don't want. And I think we have a really, really good stick design that is going to be able to accomplish what you want, as well as your buddy and your dad and your brother and your sister, and without having to go and get multiple different sticks or permanently alter them, where you're drilling holes in them and, you know, doing different things to them. We're real happy with the design, and at this point, we're just we got two sticks coming in this week that we'll take to testing. If those test well, then it's field testing for a while. If they field test well, that's when we'll at least start showing them. And then obviously, we got to get the whole manufacturing side of things along that line down, but we're hoping to release those before next season. So I guess the 2025, 2026 season.
Very cool, man. Very exciting stuff. We definitely appreciate you joining us today on Hunt and Land Van. You mentioned several times about the educational resources that you guys have there. You said YouTube videos where people can go and learn more about your products and safely how to do things. If people want to follow along with Hang Free and check out some of those educational resources, where would you push them to?
Absolutely. I would check out hangfree.co. That's going to be our website where you can find our YouTube, our Instagram, our Facebook, along with any like products. They're going to have pretty extensive descriptions, so you know exactly what you're buying, how it works, what the options are. And then if there are some confusing products, we typically will link a video directly in the description. So that's kind of like, I guess, your one-stop link to the YouTube, to the Facebook, Instagram, all of that. That'll just be hangfree.co. A lot of people think it's .com, just .co. So check it out there and let us know what you think.
Awesome, man. I think you've done a great job of walking our listeners through some very important safety aspects of saddle hunting and you know, the nuances of finding the right gear for you. So I definitely appreciate you joining us today, man. We enjoyed it.
Well, thanks for having me.
All right, guys, let's take a quick break. Check out a few of this week's great sponsors.
Baker Metalworks and Dixie Supply. Baker Metalworks and Dixie Supply offer numerous items to help get your project done right the first time. They carry a variety of different panel profiles and your choice of colors and gauges with all the matching trim and accessories. They also offer a full line of hardware items and post-frame building design. Their friendly and knowledgeable sales representatives are always willing to help answer any questions or concerns you may have. Contact them with any questions or to get a free estimate today. Baker Metalworks and Dixie Supply, your metal roofing headquarters. Southern Seed and Feed. Do you want to provide better nutrients to your deer? If so, try Southern Buck Food Plot Blends. Your deer will love it. At Southern Seed and Feed, they specialize in making textured feed for horses, cattle, sheep, goats, hogs, chickens, small animals, and wildlife. Their products are proven irresistible, scientifically formulated to promote excellent herd health and hunter satisfaction. They supply products to various distributors throughout the South. So visit their website at southernseedfeed.com or call 662-726-2638 to find the dealer nearest you.
Very cool podcast today, Nick. I appreciate you joining me. It's a little overwhelming to me, to be honest with you. It's a lot of components. It's a lot of big words that I'm not very familiar with. So I definitely appreciate you guiding us through it today. Van did a great job of explaining things, and that gravity can be tough, man. It's you got to be safe up there. Sounds like they have it figured out. I really liked what he was saying about how well they test things and how much of a rigorous testing, you know, period, I guess you would call it, that they put their ropes through and things like that. Because you know, safety is important. I don't really want to die.
Yeah, I don't want to die either. And gravity doesn't sleep. So you definitely got to be on your toes. No, I did that in a past life. I was the guy on the other end of the phone answering questions about, can I use a Madrox safeguard on 8mm rope? And is it really that big of a deal if I use a Ropeman and don't back it up? Or, hey, I weigh 450 pounds. Can I get away with this gear? I used to answer all those questions, and talking with Van, he definitely knows his stuff. I know that stuff can get in the weeds. It's simpler than it sounds, I guess, when you have two people who do it, one who does it for a living and one who used to do it for a living talking about it, you can get bogged down in the technical details. But at the end of the day, it's like he was saying, if you're buying a good product from a trusted manufacturer, you know, if you're buying, you know, Samson Predator rope, if you're using the right gear and just following the instructions, it really is just as simple as buying good gear and using it the way the manufacturer tells you to use it. If you can do those things, if you can read the instructions and follow the instructions, it's a super safe way to hunt.
Awesome, man. Good podcast. I enjoyed it. Thanks for joining me.
Absolutely.
Well, that's going to wrap it up for us this week. Appreciate you joining us. We want to make it easy for you to listen. So here's a handy option for you. To get the podcast emailed to you each week, just text the word hunting to 773-770-4377. Again, just text the word hunting to 773-770-4377. You'll join our email list, and wherever you are listening to podcasts, go ahead, subscribe, rate, and review. Send us a written review. We'd love to hear from you. If you got a show topic that you are interested in and like to see us cover, just email us at pros@landhunting.com. That's going to do it for us. Y'all stay safe out there. We'll talk to you next time.